This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is up on Center Stage, the show about the arts and the artists behind their work. When a film historian meticulously gathers information for their work, whether it be an upcoming book or presentation, we in the cinema-loving world can allow ourselves to breathe a sigh of relief. Any cinephile longing for in-depth information and the words that fall between the lines about the movies is in safe hands with an outstanding film historian. Many times I realize that there may be a perspective that I am yearning for in my own rendering of film history and facts. What I desire these days in film presentations, festivals, and publications about the film industry is the relief of being able to look back on film history. Because quite frankly, when I look at present-day film, I am not always enchanted. So it is with delight that I am able to introduce today as my guest on Center Stage, a film historian who embraces a look at the past without reservation. Foster Hirsch has spent a lifetime at the movies. His recent book, Hollywood and the Movies of the 50s, The Collapse of the Studio System, The Thrill of Cinerama, and The Ultimate Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Television, has been described as a big, ambitious book, itself a welcome throwback, and that is from the Los Angeles Times. It is his 16th book on film. His others include Otto Preminger, The Man Who Would Be King, The Dark Side of the Screen, Film Noir, and A Method to Their Madness, The History of the Actors Studio, all being met by critical acclaim. Foster Hirsch is professor of film at Brooklyn City College in New York City. He also serves as a lecturer and presenter at significant film festivals and forums around the world. I recently met him at the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival in Los Angeles, where he presented the screening of The Phoenix City Story, directed by Phil Carlson, from 1955. Welcome, Foster Hirsch. You are such a treasure, and it is such an honor to have you on Center Stage. Thank you for being with me.
And if I can live up to everything you just said, I don't know that anybody could, but thank you.
I think you can, and I think you have. You told me when we first met in LA, I said, how long have you been writing this book? And you said, for 70 years.
I wasn't consciously writing it for 70 years, but looking back, I realized that I was. Because from a very young age, my parents were both moviegoers, and they took me to the movies with them. And I knew very early on that A, I really loved the movies, and that B, I think I knew practically before I could read and write fluently that I wanted to talk about the movies and write about the movies and share my experience of the movies. And so since I grew up in the 50s, and that's what I'm writing about, those childhood experiences are very much a part of the writing of this book.
You had the advantage of growing up in Los Angeles.
I did, and that was a huge advantage. For this reason, there were great theaters in L.A. There were great theaters throughout the country in the 50s. There are almost no great theaters left. There are anonymous multiplexes. It's so depressing to go to the movies now. It wasn't the way it was when I was a kid. Every theater was, even the neighborhood theaters had some atmosphere and architectural integrity and design and flair. But movies, of course, were one of the primary industries in Los Angeles. And so growing up in L.A., and if you were interested in the movies, you knew how central the movies were to the culture of the city. And so many beautiful theaters. And my parents liked going to the first-run houses. So we went to the big theaters. I grew up going to Grauman's Chinese, to the Egyptian, to the Pantages, to the Warner Beverly, to the Fox Wilshire, to the Fine Arts. I loved these theaters. And they became part of the experience of seeing the movies.
Oh, Foster, you lucky man. You know, my parents were from Los Angeles, and when I was born, they decided to move to Oregon. And not a day goes by I don't remind them that they should have stayed in Los Angeles. So I could have been sitting next to you at Grauman's, maybe. I mean, that would have been marvelous. It would have been my dream. You've been living my dream, Foster.
No, I saw the CinemaScope on huge, wide screens, and I prize these experiences. They are indelibly fused with the movies themselves. The experience of seeing the movie and the movie itself in my mind as I was reviewing the material for the book, they became almost one. I propelled myself back into seeing Shane at Brahmin's Chinese. And the opening sentence of my book is, I remember where I sat.
Wow.
So I remember where I sat to watch these movies when I first saw them. I remember who I was with, and I remember the theaters I saw them at.
Well, one of the beautiful things you start out with in your book is proclaiming your love of looking back, that you feel the past is another planet, which I thought was very interesting. And also, you did a beautiful turn of phrase when you talked about when you felt that films were more patient in the past. And of course, covering the 50s, I think you were in that rich arena of a decade to be able to speak about
Yes,
this.
very much so. I worry about that claim that I make. There's always the risk of getting so embedded in the past that you're not living in the present. I'm probably guilty of presenting the past with a nostalgic glow, but I think at the core of it, I'm right. That certainly in terms of what I'm talking about, movie culture, the experience of going to the movies, the kinds of movies that were available, the thrill for me of movie going was so much richer in the 50s than it is now.
Yes.
I rarely go to movies now. I'm often disappointed when I do go.
But I find that your nostalgia, your looking into nostalgia, is wrapped up with a wonderful objectivity. I hear your excitement and your passion, but at the same time, I feel like we're in good hands. You have such an objective approach to everything you do, and it's so hearty and deep diving because your book is so exhaustive in research. You're delving so deeply into what is happening in the world at the time, including politics, our own national situation, and of course, what was going on in Hollywood.
I was very conscious of doing that. My brilliant editor, Victoria Wilson, very early in the project, she said to me, don't go from movie to movie. It will drive the reader crazy. So I think you said it well. I plant the movie in the soil of 1950s culture, politics, a lot of politics in the book, but cultural agendas as well. It's not just a procession of this movie, that movie, but the movie's as connected to the sense of the times.
Yeah. But, you know, me being an avid film goer, I was literally riveted about two things. One, talking about your first experience seeing Cinerama as a young person, and also the whole description of every studio, the moguls and their fall.
Yes.
And working it up to United Artists who actually came out of this on top. And you filled in so many blanks for me. It was so fascinating. I didn't realize the drama that was going behind Louis B. Mayer, for instance. I didn't realize about the College of Cardinals, for instance. All of these things that you go into such detail about.
Pam, I hope in time that will be seen as a valuable part of the book, because I do give you a history of each of the major and some of the minor studios of the era and the tumultuous events that were overtaking each of the studios, so that you get a sense of Hollywood in the 50s was an industry on the brink. It was a very dangerous time. There was a thought that the whole industry might go under. They had to reinvent themselves. And in every studio, there was a sense of inner dissension. The old-time moguls died off, or they were deposed. There were enormous changes. The only Hollywood founder who survived the decade was Jack Warner, and he lasted until 1967, the year of Bonnie and Clyde. Everybody else, through death or choice or being fired, left. And so the industry and each of the studios was under a terrific assault from outside and inside. And I wanted to present that. And then one studio, RKO, died after the colossal and nightmarish mismanagement of a man named Howard Hughes, who was a madman in charge of a major studio.
Yeah.
And he left with a profit, but he left a studio in disarray. And about a year after he left, there was no more RKO. So you had two entities that expired and changes at the top in every entity. Louis Mayer was fired in May 1951. That could happen to Mayer at MGM, the most powerful of all the moguls.
Yes.
What did that mean for the other studios and the other moguls? They were all under threat of some kind.
Do you think this was a product of America coming into a new era of having a global dominance?
Absolutely. But did that have an impact on the culture of the studios? I don't think so. I think what it was changes in movie-going habits. The audience began to shrink. During the war years, people went to the movies on a daily or weekly basis. Enormous audience size. Television comes in the late 40s, early 50s, the audience begins to shrink. People
Right.
move from the cities to the suburbs. There's a shrinkage because of that as well. Tastes change. So for so many reasons, financial structure of the studios was imperiled. It's a good question you raise about our new world prominence.
Yeah.
So I talk a
Yeah.
lot about that. That has something to do maybe with the content of the movies, but I don't know that it had a direct impact on the studio's dangerous financial situation in 1950.
I ask that just because it was such a huge transitional moment for us, and we went into such an era of conservative behavior. So it's interesting how there was not a huge range for independent filmmakers, even though that did come into that decade. But with Louis V. Mayer, everything had to be perfect, right?
His
Please.
vision for MGM, he says, we make beautiful films about beautiful people. And if that is not what you believe in, you don't belong here. So he
Yeah.
had a very idealized vision of, quotes, America, an idealized Americana. And his quintessential film is Meet Me in St. Louis, the all-American Midwestern family
Right, right.
in this sort of American Arcadia. He didn't want movies to reflect harsh reality. That's one of the reasons he was deposed, because in the last few years of his reign, MGM began to lose a sizable amount of money. And so they
Right.
had to get somebody else who would be more up to the moment. And they got Doris Sherry, who, very different from Louis B. Mayer, wanted to make social dramas and black and white films about serious issues. And exactly what you talk about, the Donna Reed syndrome, he wanted to make films against Ozzie and Harriet
Yes.
and the idealized father knows best vision of the American family.
What did you think, Foster, about Dori Shari yourself?
Well, my editor said Doris Sherry was responsible for the destruction of MGM. I didn't feel that way. I thought he made a lot of good movies. He changed the profile of the studio. The problem was that under his management, the studio didn't make money. And so he was deposed too in 1956. And MGM never recovered. By the end of the decade, it was a ghost of its former self. It never recovered the prominence that it had had before the war under Mayer. So I don't know that anybody could have saved MGM. And I think it's sort of unfair to blame Doris Sherry. I thought he had good taste. He was intelligent. He was interested in a wide range of subject matter. Yes, he was a progressive, as that was defined in the 50s, left wing, and open to films about race and film noir and dark films. Doris Sherry's early success is Asphalt Jungle, which is a
Oh,
film about a
yes.
heist, a very dark vision of America. Louis B. Mayer said, I wouldn't walk across the street to see a film like that.
It's
It was a
interesting.
hit at the time.
Dori
Never
Shari had
believed.
his moments.
He made some good films, but he couldn't save a studio that was poised for dissolution.
And the whole political ramifications, I mean, behind the scenes, you've got the guys in New York with the money. Whether it was Western Electric or who, and everybody trying to get along and pull everything together, which never seemed to work in the 50s. And then the flamboyant characters, these flamboyant moguls.
Well, what I've enjoyed writing about the history of the studios as they were nearing their end, the studio system. The guys who ran them were so colorful. They
Yeah.
had such personalities. They were very sure of their taste. They were buccaneers. They were sort of financial geniuses. They had a sense of artistic taste. They were not businessmen who were selling any product. They were selling movies,
Yeah,
and they
yeah,
cared about movies.
yeah, and
Name
stars.
one mogul today. They're interchangeable. Corporate entities. One studio has no different profile from the other. One studio head of state, no different from the other. But in my book, in this rich period, you have Louis B. Mayer, Doris Sherry, Harry Warner, Harry Cohn, Darryl Zanuck, Howard Hughes. They were wonderfully colorful characters, like them or not.
It's incredible. I want to know at RKO. So here we have Howard Hughes stepping in, eccentric, a madman, yeah, having his own definite biases about leading ladies. But yet, that is a studio that mounted Rashomon.
It released Rashomon.
Okay.
It didn't
Okay.
produce it, but it released it in America.
And how did
And
that
once,
happen?
well, now, once in a while, Howard Hughes knew when to sit back and shut up and don't interfere. There
Okay.
were some very good films released under his reign, but often he would interfere and withdraw a film and cut it and recut it and ask for reshoots, and it didn't make any sense. Once in a while, when he saw real talent, he would just back off.
Interesting. Very interesting. Wow. What do you think of the film Aviator, Martin Scorsese's film about Hughes?
Yeah, an idealized version.
Yeah, I think so too. Beautifully made.
Pure, beautifully made, pure fiction.
Wonderful use of classical music, as
All of the
always, with
above,
Mr. Scorsese.
but fiction, not true biography.
Now, I want to talk to you about your love of Cinerama, specifically Cinerama. You start your book talking about this, even in the introduction, and we can hear the whimsy of this child seeing this huge thing, which I guess became the IMAX theater eventually.
The IMAX is more or less the contemporary equivalent of Cinerama. Not the same, and to me, not as impressive or overwhelming.
Interesting.
Cinerama was oceanic.
Wow.
You were surrounded by sight and sound. The shape of the Cinerama screen, what entailed our peripheral vision, that is what we could, as far as the eye could see, there was an image in front of us, and there was nothing else but the image. So you felt engulfed and surrounded. It was terrifically exciting when the screen parted, because this is Cinerama started very shrewdly with the old Academy ratio, a small screen, boxy screen. And then Lowell Thomas, our host, said, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is Cinerama." And the screen opened, the curtains parted, and you heard the 7-track stereo sound coming at you from front and back and sides and all over the auditorium. And we were placed on the ride, the roller coaster ride at the Palisades. We took that ride,
Wow.
and it was the first uncut, no cutting. We went on that ride, and the sound surrounded us. It was thrilling. I remember the moment I saw it in April 1953, where I sat, who I was with. I loved it. I've seen Cinerama since, because you can't see Cinerama any place in the world. There's no theater that can accommodate it. But there's what's called Smilebox DVD. They simulate the widescreen, so you can, they're beautifully produced, so you can get a sense of what those films were like on your home screens. And I think the films hold up. I think they're wonderful artifacts of 1950s America. And talk about
Oh.
what you said, how we were a new world power, how prosperous we were, how
Yes.
conservative in many ways, how ensconced we were in consumerist culture and gaining things. We lived well. America was a prosperous nation. I don't mean everybody, but I mean a large majority of people.
Of course.
And Cinerama speaks to that sense of well-being. It is the purest representation in films I know of the ethos of post-war America.
Wow.
But I encourage people, they can't see Cinerama. Nobody can. But you can see an approximation in the Smilebox releases. All the travelogue films of the period are available.
Of course. Wow. And you were there with Lowell Thomas, who is really responsible for bringing us not the film per se of Lawrence of Arabia, but the man.
Oh, it's responsible for the man, for sure. He was an extraordinary figure in himself.
He could sell anything, couldn't he, Foster?
Yes, he could. He had a wonderful voice and wonderful presence. He was a terrific host for not all of the films, but some of them.
How exciting. So we had Cinerama, we had CinemaScope, 3D, VistaVision. Of all of these, what did you feel was the most successful?
The most successful, absolutely, was CinemaScope. CinemaScope was a widescreen process, much wider than the Academy ratio, but it wasn't as wide or as cumbersome as Cinerama, which was
Okay.
almost too big for telling stories. It was good for a travelogue, but hard to get intimacy or dramatic narrative. But CinemaScope brought the image down very, very large, wide, and you could tell stories about the ancient world and westerns and spectacle films in ways that you couldn't have done in earlier size screens. But why we remember CinemaScope is that it saved the industry. Darryl Zanuck introduced it to 20th Century Fox in 1953 in a movie called The Rogue, which nobody knows now, but I'm telling you, as a historian, it is a movie that saved Hollywood.
Hollywood.
When I've been doing retrospectives in connection with my book, I haven't been able to convince one programmer to screen The Rogue. One programmer said, "Oh, it's too academic." Another programmer said, "I'm happy to do a film series for you to promote your book. We'll do a lot of movies, but do I have to show The Rogue?"
Oh my gosh.
Well, it's a Christian epic. It would never be made today as a life-saving film, an industry-saving film. It's obviously a film of its time. The early 50s, Christianity or religion had a much more prominent part in the national life than it does now.
Of
You
course.
couldn't possibly make a story about early Christianity today and expect it to reach other than a very specific targeted audience. In 1953, The Rogue was a film for everyone. Families went to see it. Generations went to see it. People loved it. And if you look at it fairly, you see how well made it is, how artfully it uses the new widescreen process. I'm a huge fan of the film, but I can't convince anybody to show it.
I'm
It
so
has
sorry.
bad odor.
I'm so sorry about that because I'm actually am still a fan of the Christian epic films. I find them fascinating.
They're fascinating. They're terrific.
And mainly because
Ben-Hur
they
is one of
bring
the greatest films ever made.
ever made.
Ever made.
Yakima Canutt. I mean, right down to all the special effects at that time, the fact that during the Great Chariot Race, there is no music. What a winner.
Not
And
one
look what we
minute of
do with
music.
that today. You look at Ridley Scott's Gladiator, which we're pushed by Hans Zimmer's score in a similar kind of situation in Gladiator, which of course it's riveting, but it's just not the same.
Not the same.
The attention on the visual is so profound.
And
Wow.
also in Ben-Hur, those people in the arena are all real people. It's not CGI.
It's not CGI. Quite. Yeah, these big spectacles, I just love it. You talk about Darryl Zanuck. I mean, he was one of the most flamboyant in the end with all his League of Mistresses. He was a movie in himself.
He's an extraordinary figure. I actually nominate him as the best old school Hollywood mogul. The shrewdest, the most successful. He saved the industry with the introduction of CinemaScope, and he sold CinemaScope to all the other studios. Every studio but Paramount adopted CinemaScope. Fox was, as they said, married to CinemaScope. Every film they released in the 50s was in CinemaScope. The other studios used CinemaScope by choice for particular projects. Only Paramount rejected CinemaScope and they introduced their own widescreen process called VistaVision.
Yes, I remember it well.
But VistaVision had a short lifespan. It was
Interesting.
introduced in 54. It was pretty much over. I think the last film was One-Eyed Jacks in 61. They never could differentiate how they were different from or better than the dominant CinemaScope. And
Correct,
I never knew myself how large was the VistaVision screen. How wide would it be? How high? This division was very good for detail and depth and clarity, but it never sold itself to the industry, and other studios
Interesting.
didn't use it much, almost not at all.
Very interesting. Everybody
So
had to do their thing.
CinemaScope marketed itself brilliantly because of Darryl Zanuck. Then after he saved Fox, saved the industry in 1956, he leaves. He leaves because perhaps he was having a midlife crisis. He had a mistress, and then he had another mistress. They were always European. The first one was Bela Darvey, and then the second one was Juliet Greco, and he made several films to showcase her talents. Problem was she could sing, but she couldn't act. And then she turned out to be very ungrateful to him and wrote a terrible tell-all book about him. But there were a series of them. Then he came back. They brought him back in the 60s, and he was at Fox for the land office business for Sound of Music, which saved the industry again in
Again,
the 60s. But that's a story
that's another book,
for a
Foster.
different decade. My next book, that's my next book, volume two, is the Hollywood and the Movies of the 60s.
And we are going to have that, aren't we?
We are going to have that. And
I am
certainly Sound of
so
Music and the
excited.
history of Sound of Music will be a prominent part of that story.
I love it. Foster Hirsch is not just a scholar of the classic film world. It is his passion. I hope you will join us next week for part two of this fascinating discussion as we speak about melodrama, Douglas Sirk, and more magic of the films of the 1950s. You can find more information about my guest at fosterhirsch.inc. And definitely search out his book, Hollywood and the Movies of the 1950s, his 16th book on the history of film. The music you have heard today, as chosen by my guest, is the theme from the 1952 film Moulin Rouge, recorded by Percy Faith, with vocals by Felicia Saunders. If you go to centerstagewithpamelacoon.com, you will find more shows like this. I hope you will join me next week, and until then, stay safe, everyone. This is Pamela Coon, and the curtain is now down on Center Stage.